The following interview was conducted with Professor Charles Ernstman for the Purdue University Oral History Program. It took place on Monday, May the 5th, 2008, at his office in Zucker Labs. The interviewer is Catherine Marquis, the Oral History Librarian. This is part two of a previous interview. Go ahead, sir. I'll let you get started. He's going to share some of his reminiscences of the university and students and the curriculum.
Uh-huh. One of the things I felt was a major change was the personal association, particularly between the professors and the students. And of course, there's a lot of interchange in the students that had disappeared as well. But back in the early days, I can remember going from class to class across the campus. Quite frequently, I would see President Hovde sitting on a bench with two or three students just chatting. And I think Hakama was his vice president at the time, and he would do the same. And it wasn't just once a week. I'd see him more than that. And that was gave you the feeling that they weren't all that remote, that you could have contact. And I was just talking to one of the professors before this interview, and he was pointing out exactly that the ability, the accessibility of the professors was much greater back in the earlier days than it is today. And this might be partly due to the electronics involved. And I think in the earlier interview I mentioned I was taking air breathing and rocket propulsion course from Professor Zucro, and I got stuck on some problems, and he said, well, come on up to my house. And that's when he lived over on 9th Street Hill, and so I went over to his house for help. Now, how many times do you do that today? It's not too frequently. And so I think that the atmosphere was, it was a large school still, but they still managed to keep the small school atmosphere, is what mm-hmm. I would say, I guess. And I think that's one of the things that we've lost today, and part of that may be due to the electronic communication that we have now. And I think if we look at the society in general, we find that people communicate email rather than personal, so you're losing a personal contact and all of the things that can generate from that, where you can have a relationship that enhances both of your lives, where email really is a very unemotional thing. And I think that's one of the things. And then, of course, in the case of the university, what we're seeing now is they moved from, I was checking with one of the other professors that I remember was around here many, many years, and Professor Hoffman, and he was pointing out that, I've got to look at my numbers here, that the IBM 7094 was the first computer that was put in here at the university, and it was housed in the math building, which is on University Street across from the Armory. I don't know if you remember that. And then
big
cabinets, huge, a whole room full of cabinets. And then the input for the early computers was punch cards. So they had to punch. I can remember Joe Hoffman taking over to the same building, because at the early going, that was the only place you could input. We didn't have any satellite terminals like they did later. And so he would take these drawers in his car and go over to input his data to process his problem. And then he'd have to wait there to get the output. And then later they established satellite terminals where you could input your cards at the satellites, and but you still had to pick up the response over at Mass.
At the mainframe.
Yes, off the mainframe, right. And then they moved on into an IBM and a cyber, and got a little more capability, but there was still a lot of punch cards involved. And in fact, Professor Hoffman did most of his research, calculated responses on the punch cards during his getting his doctorate degree. So I think this is one thing now, if you look at our present circumstance, now you can contact your mainframe from your laptop. And so you can do everything almost anywhere, and you can run some real complex problems, because all you have to do is call up the right program from the from the home-based computer and just provide the input to it and
go from there.
And go from there, yeah. And so it's that has been a major change. Another facet that has enhanced it or come about because of electronic equipment is the class notes. I can remember when I was a student that if I missed class, I had to get a hold of a buddy that took notes and get his copy and hope that he had taken a fairly good set. What do you do today? Well, many of the courses, you can call up the class notes from the computer, and they're input by the professor. In fact, the lecture is often done that way. The only thing you miss there is the question-answer periods. You don't get that information. And so now we've reduced personal relationships even farther by going that route, because I know my grandson took an education course here and got his teaching license in history, teaches in one of the schools down there in Indianapolis, and he used to call up the lecture notes off the computer. He did that, in fact, out of my house, so I was surprised at that, you know. And so, of course, we have a step in between, which is published notes, which several professors put out, but in the case of engineering, where if you were in an area that was making a lot of progress, quite often material would change very rapidly, so that the professor was having to keep altering his
sure.
his notes, so to upgrade.
Yeah.
And, so I think the introduction of the electronic age, if we want to call it that, has reduced personal relationships, which we discussed earlier, and then it's also made the personal contact in classroom, that'd be with other students as well, because they're busy working with their laptops.
Right. So. How has registration changed over time? The registration process changed since you've been here.
Well,
since you were talking about the computer, didn't it used to be maybe in the armory years ago?
Oh, yeah.
Might want to share a comment on that.
In fact, I can remember when I was a student, that's what they did. It was at the armory. Pardon me. And you had to register in writing.
Didn't they have a board up there or some sort of a screen to see what was available?
Then board was listing the available courses, and so you could sign up, and it was an interesting affair. It was done alphabetically. There's so many letters each day, because I remember they didn't do, they didn't take mechanical engineering and just devote a day to it. Oftentimes it was more than one day
sure.
to get there, mostly alphabetical.
Right,
But yeah, that was, I had forgotten about that. I'm glad you reminded me
right,
of it.
Yeah. What about the counseling of the students? That's changed over
the
time.
What?
Counseling of students, the one I, because with registration changing, that impacts on the counseling
yeah.
and the guidance that you give them.
Well, I can only speak for ME.
Sure, that's fine.
Pardon me. And but we have a counselor, and his responsibility, he has I don't want to call her a secretary, but it's a assistant. And so if a student has a scheduling problem or wants to know what courses to take, if he wants to specialize in a certain area, he can go and find the counseling is available. And so ME has that. I'm not sure about all the other schools.
Mm-hmm. Well, quite a few
I'm
schools.
I'm pretty sure Double E does
sure.
as well.
Right. And of course, in the first year, you go to freshman for engineering education, and then there's people there if you're looking to get some guidance on what school you might be interested in.
Yeah.
They do start at that first level.
Yeah. The campus wide consulting
sure.
Consultation takes place.
Right.
At other locations, but
right.
I know our school does. I know Double E does because I know one of the professors
right.
that did it
right.
at Double E, and
right.
So that helps the student, gives him guidance,
right.
and,
which they often need.
Yeah.
What about the curriculum? Were you involved in? There were changes to keep up with what's.
Yes, the area. Pardon me. The area that I worked in was we looked at an analysis of mainly the main thrust was the response of mechanical systems dynamically. So if you provided a real sharp input, how did the system respond? So we called this statics and dynamics, which is the course title, and in it they looked at the response of mechanical systems. Now these were, that particular course was one of the initial course, and it looked at physical systems, masses. You could characterize about any system as a mass and a spring and a damper. Where a damper could be friction or actually a physical damper like you have in your automobile.
Sure.
And then you modeled the systems, and then you could predict their response to certain inputs. And then that was extended then to look at instrumentation, where you're trying to measure a varying pressure. How does the system respond? Well, you can analyze it dynamically, applying your dynamics. And so we had an instrumentation course, which was strongly flavored toward dynamic response. And now, most of these systems are characterized mathematically, so if you can characterize your input mathematically, you can predict the system response from it.
Okay.
Back in those days, you couldn't. You had to run some tests to get results, and then from that you could predict what the damping was in the system, what the failure to respond properly was caused by.
Sure.
And
that reflects the changes, as I said
yeah.
earlier, how the curriculum reflects the change in focus, in research, and what the market, what people are studying, and
yeah.
whatever.
In the propulsion area, the main early thrust and propulsion was in air breathing, because the individual that taught the course was strong in that area, and there were people that could assist him. And then, of course, there was the fact that Allison Engine was down in Indianapolis, which was very supportive of Purdue when it was Allison. And in fact, Rolls Royce does a pretty good job now.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was kind of the strong flavor in propulsion early, with a sort of a minor shot at rockets. And then eventually, as rockets progressed, and this was probably motivated with the initiation of the the moonshot. Well, satellite, launching satellites probably is really what initiated it.
Sure.
Then rockets became independent, and there was a series of courses you could take in rockets only, and then another series in air breathing engines only. And they expanded the air breathing to include ramjets, and of course today supersonic ramjets, such as are used in some of the airplanes today.
Mm-hmm.
And the rockets, of course, the big boom was in the moonshot Apollo.
Sure.
And my understanding now, I just heard on the news that we've contracted with Russia for so many flights to the space station because they're going to retire the shuttle.
That's what I hear.
So we keep talking about sending our labor outside the country. Well, there's certainly a case. And now they've had, what, two rough landings. So
yeah.
There's concern now about whether that's the right way to go. But apparently the present administration doesn't want to invest the money in another vehicle. The one that they've NASA's working on is one that won't be ready for a number of years yet.
Right.
After they retire the shuttle, so there's a gap in there.
Right.
So what they're doing is going with the Russians until then. But in any event, the world is catching up.
We're moving forward.
Yeah, moving forward. Right. Moving some of it
out there.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Well, people complain about sending jobs outside the United States, and that's certainly one.
Yeah.
And then the fact that they've had a couple bad landings now, no one was killed, but they...
does shake you up a little
close
bit.
Close to it, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Yeah. What about any university committees? Did you serve on any, were you on the Senate at all, or
well,
school?
Let's see, I'm trying to think. I was on the, what did they call that committee? It's the, I think it was an education committee. Would that sound right?
Could be. Could be something in the Senate.
Whenever school was engineering school. Now this is all engineering.
Okay.
Was thinking of initiating a change in their curriculum. They had to go through this committee to get it approved,
right.
And then we would recommend to the administration that it be approved.
Okay.
And so we were a key part of that.
Sure.
And I served on that, I can't remember what year it was, but it was...
Sometime, a little while back. That's good.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Tell us about the academic rank, how the changes, promotion thing has changed over time.
The chain?
Change, it's changed a little bit, hasn't it?
I think that as far as promotions are concerned, I think the criteria, I think, is still pretty much the same.
Mm-hmm.
There has to be a definitely demonstrated performance,
right.
And it has to be demonstrated over a period of time.
Right.
And then if there's a promotion within that particular area, then it's granted. If you're looking for, say, a promotion over all of the schools of engineering, then that's a little tougher to come by because you may be taking a mechanical engineer, putting him in over AA and so forth,
sure.
Civil. And,
right.
However, let's see, I was on the Military Programs Committee. I forgot that. Yeah.
Good, okay.
And what we did, our responsibility there was we had to interview and pass the incoming commanders for the ROTC program. So whenever they were going to change commanders, now this is the military guy, not the ROTC.
Right, understand.
We would have to interview them and then make a recommendation to the university, and then they would approve a certain person.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I forgot that.
Were they here for a certain period of time?
I had an opportunity there, which was a lot of fun. But we went up to Grissom, and at the time, Grissom was one of the major bases for refueling airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
And we flew on a refueling mission from Grissom out over to Nebraska, refueled an airplane, and we got to lay down next to the boom operator and see him hook up. And there was one, two, three, four of us. So it wasn't a crowd. And then since I had had some experience with dead reckoning navigation, I was chatting with the navigator, and he said, "Well, why don't you sit down here and navigate us back to Grissom?" I said, "Okay." Well, I missed it by 7 miles, and that wasn't too bad.
You're in the ballpark.
Yeah, but that was one of the fun things on that committee, in that they took us all up there and
sure.
Gave us a ride.
Yeah.
Refueling plane.
Right. What were your special research areas that you concentrated on?
My research.
As
a professor.
Right.
Primarily rocket work.
Okay.
We have a facility that we built here in the 1960s to run rocket engines at high pressure, and Dr. Zucro had gotten a grant from NASA for $750,000, and then another one from Washington. Oh boy, what was that from? But the total came out to about $1.2 million. And I think in my earlier interview,
right.
I indicated I was asked to come back
sure.
and help with that.
Right. And then you continued on in this
so
area.
So then I also started doing my research there. And what we were looking at was running rocket engines up to very high chamber pressures. And we, at that facility, made it up to 4,000, so it was about 4,500 pounds per square inch pressure, chamber pressure. At the time we were doing that work, the most commonly used pressure was about 350 pounds per square inch pressure. And I think I pointed that out maybe in the previous interview, I'm not sure, but one of the NASA officials was here and told Zucro and me we were wasting our time working at this high pressure. It was not useful. And now we'd already predicted that at sea level, high pressure would, in fact, enhance performance. As it turned out, that same NASA official wound up in charge of the main engines on the shuttle, which ran at 6,000 PSI pressure. So I thought he didn't like high pressure. But, of course, the pressure is a significant advantage at the lower altitudes, and in space it doesn't really make that much difference.
Okay.
How much expanded to.
Sure.
And what we did there was worked on self-igniting propellants, nitrogen tetroxide and mixed halogen fuel, and all you had to do is bring them together in a light, and then we ran that up to high chamber pressure. And it took I'd say probably a good year and a half to get the pressure up high enough. Now, we built a system, of course, to tolerate it. But
sure.
And there was one thing we had to be concerned with the system was if the stand blew up, we wanted to be able to shut those propellants off awful quick. Otherwise, you had a big fire. So we had to replace some of the valves with fast-acting valves that could close in 1 to 2 milliseconds. And so that was another search through industry to try to find a company that could build one.
Sure.
and we finally did and got the program off.
Good.
And then we did heat transfer. The alloy, the alloy that was used in the shuttle main engines was a copper zirconia alloy, and the zirconia gives copper strength, and copper gives you good conductivity, so you can transfer heat, because rocket engines run at very high temperatures, and so they wanted to use copper, but they added zirconia for giving physical strength. Well, the zirconia would come out of solution and form crystals, and then once it formed crystals, then cracks in the copper would propagate from the crystals, and the chamber would fail. And Rocketdyne had encountered that, and they were searching for an a method of introducing the zirconia where it would not come out of solution and form crystals. So we ran samples of this alloy in our high-pressure rocket engine, because the heat transfer rate was almost the same as we would have gotten in the main engine on the shuttle. So we could expose it to the same environment. And then we would cycle it, and then they would take the sample back and analyze it to see if the zirconia came out or not. And that problem was finally solved and incorporated on the main engines for the shuttle by Rocketdyne.
Very good.
Yeah.
Very good. Yeah. Any other some thoughts? And don't talk. Change one thing: preservation and archives. There's movement. What are your, is your thoughts on that? Saving the things.
Well, my feeling is, of course, being history, I guess, is that we should do that, because. I guess one of the things I see is that we have a lot of experience. I see this in the rocket area, because that's what I'm specialized in, that we've had a lot of experience in that area. And if there was access to the history of what went on when under certain conditions, we could avoid errors that we're going to make again, because it's not available. You can, if you know it existed, then you can probably find it. But a lot of the students and professors don't know that. And as a result, there isn't a nice place to go search for that subject. So I think that an archival library is extremely important for technical progress. Not only from the preservation of history, but also the advancement of technology, because I see things happen in the rocket industry that are repeats of previous experiments or work that's been done, development work, and as a result, time's wasted. If they had just gone into literature, they could have, if they had an archival
right.
response.
Yeah. Good.
So I'm very much in favor of it.
Good.
And right now, as I think I mentioned before, I've received a whole lot of material on a particularly unique rocket engine called the plug nozzle, which I would like to put in Purdue's archival library and make it accessible to the nation, because it's still not an idea that should be tossed out. It may still be used. In fact, on the X-33, they were going to use a plug nozzle. And then, of course, they canceled the program, so it didn't happen. But those people could have acquired a lot of information from couple of individuals that I know that could put a leg up on development tests for plug nozzles.
Yeah.
And so I'm in much in favor of what I wanted to do is put this literature, which the individual worked on it, is willing to give to Purdue's library, and they will archive it.
Mm-hmm.
If it's just going to be stacked up in a box somewhere with no records, he doesn't want to do that.
Sure.
But if it's going to be made available, if somebody at Cornell can go to their library and look and see what Purdue's got on that subject, and they can find it because you've indexed it, then I think it's very useful.
Right. We'll see on that.
Yeah, I'm in, very much in favor of that. Yeah.
Any, go ahead, some other reminiscences that you wanted to share with for the researchers?
What's that?
Any other reminiscences that you'd like to share?
Well, what I've been doing is some of the students haven't had a lot of experience in experimental work. And I think one of the important parts of any research program is, okay, you can sit down and theorize, you can do a whole bunch of calculations and predict, but until you prove it experimentally, it doesn't carry a lot of weight. And so what happens in our cycle here is quite often a student will do all of the paper research and whatever calculations are required using the techniques we've mentioned earlier, facilities. And then once he gets his predictions and they look promising, then he has to go to an actual experiment to prove that in fact the system does behave that way. And so when that comes about, then quite often some of the professors will send their students in and I'll help them with the system to get, because I've done a lot of it and I stay fairly current, so.
That's very good.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. Do you work with, say, graduate students or undergraduate?
That's grad students.
Grad students.
Yeah, we have no undergrad students here.
Okay.
I think that it's a matter of the staff's personal choice. I don't think it's necessarily a good one. I think if we had undergrads that were here as technical assistants or something like that, that we might be able to stimulate some of them into doing graduate work in the particular same area.
Sure.
But we don't, professors just don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And what we've done here is most of the students, grad students, do their mechanical work, installation work, but fabrication work is done by a shop. And then they have to come up with a design to give to the shop to build, and then they have to install it and check it out. And then they also have to design their control system so it controls experiment the way it should. And with rockets particularly, you've got to be sure that all of the events are occurring properly. And I think probably one of the things that comes to mind is in the early going here at Purdue, and this is a result of an Air Force decision, that they wanted to go to white fuming nitric acid as a rocket oxidizer and jet fuel as a fuel. Well, if you mix as little as a teacup of that together and then heat it up, it'll detonate like a stick of TNT. It'll blow a hole in your chamber wall or whatever. And so now we got to worry about accumulating that amount of propellant in a rocket before it fires. We don't want that to happen, do we? So we have to design a control system then to keep that quantity below the critical limit.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so those are the kind of problems that we have to deal with working with the rocket system.
Right. So you keep pretty active in your retirement, don't you? You're in?
Well, I do, yes. And I probably another activity I have is doing papers on subjects that have not, in a rocket area, that have not been particularly explored. And one I can mention real quick is General Electric did a lot of work on rockets at Malta up near Syracuse, New York. You look at the published information, there's very little available. So I thought, well, gee, that's a good subject. So I got a hold of a lot of the people that used to work there and generated a paper and gave it at the AIAA Joint Propulsion Conference.
Very good.
So that's the kind of thing I do devote some of my time to. And then I've been active in the AIAA. I was deputy director for education for Region 3, which is Ohio, Indiana, Michigan, Kentucky, Illinois, and Wisconsin. And in that position, I had to organize the student conference each year, which we tried to have different universities host. By the way, Purdue had hosted it 3 years ago. And the last one was University of Western Michigan. Before that was University of Notre Dame. And before that was Ohio State. So we skip around. And
stay within the region, though. That's nice.
Yeah, it's all in the region.
Good, good.
And then the students present papers there. And this gives them some experience because the committee that we have, or the judges, I should say, that we have, judging the quality of the papers and the presentation are people out of industry who have been down the road. And so it gives the student good experience in that he's presenting his paper not to a OG whiz audience, but an audience that will be critical.
That can really
and
critique
so it's
it.
It's a building thing for the student. That's why we have it. Yeah.
Right. That's very good.
And so I've just bowed out of that. Now we've got a new regional director, and so he's appointed a guy from, University of Illinois, Chicago. And, so
but you'll be a resource.
We'll see how that works out. You know? So I'm trying to give him all of the experience that I've had and hopefully help him out.
Resources are very helpful and very needed.
Yeah.
Any other comments that you think you covered pretty much what you wanted to share with the researchers?
What's that?
You think you've pretty much covered what you wanted to share with the researchers on your work?
Well, that's what I do.
Right.
Now, there's a lot of other work going on.
Oh, sure.
That's sponsored by other professors.
Sure.
I think probably one of the ones that's of a lot of interest now nationally is the pulse detonation propulsion system. This is a system that they put a fuel-air mixture in a tube, and then they light one end of it, and then the pressure wave that's generated by the combustion accelerates up to acoustic velocity, and so it's detonation velocity. And so when it comes out of the end of the pipe, it sounds like an explosion, like a gun, because that's a detonation. A rifle would be a detonation source, and except that now we want that detonation to occur at real high frequency. So they had a program here at the lab in which they got up. I know they've gotten up to 32 detonations per second, and that gets into the region of propulsion. Well, why use it? Well, you get more efficient. You can burn your fuel and air mixture more efficiently, in that you can gain some 15 to 20% propulsion out of your same pound of fuel air mixture that you could over just running it through a jet engine.
Sure.
And pulse detonation technology has been researched and is of national interest now. And,
okay.
So they're
doing
some of that.
That sounds most encouraging.
Here as well.
Yeah. Very good.
Yeah.
Okay. Any closing comments that you'd like to share with us?
Well, I think I've the point that I would like to see is have the circumstances at the university set up such that more personal contact can be stimulated, I should say, and make it an asset. If we talked about promotion and the criteria for promotion, maybe part of that could be your contact with the students. And of course, the student's input does help in the evaluation of the professor, but I mean, to me, a good bit of the, there's considerable amount of education occurs in casual conversations on maybe the subject of the course with the professor, but not necessarily focused on your problem. Maybe just discussing some of the general information that the professor has, which will enhance the student's background. So I would guess my feeling would be, is there some way we could stimulate that interaction, enhance it again in our present environment, which is really stifling it, in my opinion.
All right. Okay. Thank you very much, Professor Ernst. My pleasure.